This podcast is intended for educational purposes only and is not medical or legal advice. Always follow your local policies, procedures, and protocols when functioning in your respective profession. Additionally, the views expressed by the speakers and owners of this podcast are their own and do not represent the views of their respective employers. Listener discretion is advised.
Alert Medic 1, respond.
Ken, Josh, and Mustafa here. Welcome back to the Alert Medic 1 podcast.
All right, we're live, right?
Yep.
Hey, what's up, everybody out there in the Alert Medic 1 universe? We've got a super cool episode for you guys tonight. I have the one and only Bill Dungy from 6 Feet. You might know him on the social media and the grams and the Facebooks as 6 Foxtrot.
Yes, sir.
Cue crowd noises. Hey, Bill, why don't you tell us a little bit about where you're coming from and a little bit about your background and how you came to be 6 Feet and 6 Foxtrot.
Yeah, sure thing. So I wear a whole bunch of different hats. I'm a volunteer firefighter. I'm a registered social service worker here in the great province of Ontario, Canada. And I'm a small business owner, a dad, and a father. So I have a whole bunch of different roles. And I think the thing that ties all of those together is the need for me to be resilient. And I practice resilience in a very actionable way through 6 Feet. 6 Feet is a federally registered not-for-profit organization up here in Canada. And I started that with 2 provincial police officer friends of mine. And what we're trying to do is bring real-world resilience skills to first responders. That's like what underpins all of our work. The primary way that we do that is we have a free Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu club. And I teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu to a handful of first responders and civilians alike. What I like most about that is that it's a closed group, so we don't have to deal with like Joe Public. And 6 Feet, the name comes from the fact that this whole operation is run out of my basement. So my beautiful, loving, caring wife let me retrofit half of our house into a martial arts club. And we started through COVID, so it's kind of like a double name, right? The 6 Feet, you know, social distancing thing. But as well, it's like literally 6 feet under the ground. So kind of a memento mori in that way, too.
Whoa.
I love memento mori.
Yes. That's deep, so to speak.
Yeah.
I couldn't help myself. I couldn't help it. I'm sorry. I had to do it. So how do you convince a wife to, hey, babe, look, I know you love me and I love you, but I want to have a bunch of dudes over and we can throw ourselves around in the basement. Is that okay?
Well, I mean,
how do you do that?
When the whole world shut down, all of our jiu-jitsu clubs shut down. And, you know, I kind of make the joke that jiu-jitsu keeps me off the front page of the paper. And, you know, if you've been doing something like jiu-jitsu and the out that gives you physically and emotionally and cognitively and whatever, when that is suddenly snatched away, like I was just on a vibration, man. I had to choke somebody. So, I mean, you know, like in jiu-jitsu.
Sure.
That and, you know, I had explained to my wife kind of what I was getting after and what I was trying to do, which is kind of dissimilar from regular jiu-jitsu clubs. Like, for example, we host some interesting mindset development exercises after our jiu-jitsu class. So it's not just structurally martial arts. And she was behind it. And it got easier to discuss once a bill-sized hole was put into one of the walls. And I said, hey, we should really get some like mats on the walls here. And then it just kind of like grew like this virus in my basement, bigger.
I was going to ask if you guys were heading down to Home Depot or whatever you guys have up there in Ontario with a pallet of drywall kind of outside your place.
Yeah, it's if we ever move from this spot, when we take down the mats that are on the walls, there's several like skull formations and stuff in there that are going to have to be patched over for sure.
Bill Dungy's also a mud and taping expert for drywall.
That's right. No, actually, what's funny is one of our guys came over and offered to just help me drywall, being the nice guy that he is. Mark, he's one of our jiu-jitsu guys. And he's become this like ad hoc drywaller now within the club. And he's not like super duper proficient, he would tell you. But now since he did it once for 6 feet, he's the drywall guy. That's how it works out. You know?
That's how that stuff works out, right? So one of the things that made me fall in love with 6 feet and six frocks trot was this video I ran across. And the tagline from the video, it was something along the lines of, you know, the people we serve expect a standard, and that standard's almost impossible, but they desperately wish that you would be, and I'm paraphrasing, who they hope you signed up to be. And man, I loved it. I was like, oh, man. I started devouring everything on the website. I was like, I'm going to follow this guy. I'm going to check this guy out. And it was amazing. And if you guys out there in the listening world, get on the YouTubes and Google the Six Foxtrot stuff and find that video. There's only a handful of them, right, Bill?
Yeah.
And I think it's like the first one you did.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was, golly, man, it was so amazing. I was like, I was hitting a spot in kind of where I was in my career, in my life. And man, I read that and I went, shit, I got to start like really, really working out. Not just going to get in a pump. I have to really start working out. Now, there's a difference, obviously. I mean, apparently there's a difference, right? You can go and get a pump, or you can actually go and build some endurance, to use your word.
Yeah.
Tell me where that came from. Where did this post and where did this diatribe on the heroic ideal, where did that come from?
Yeah, man, I'd love to. This is one thing that I really like speaking on because it makes people feel uncomfortable. And that's how I know I'm really getting towards something that matters. Because for the most part, if you want to make a group of first responders, military personnel, frontline workers, anybody who's working in a direct capacity with the public when the public's not having a great day, you want to make them feel uncomfortable, call them heroes. And I think that's a great place to start when we're talking to brand new recruits about what the expectation might look like. But I'll tell you exactly where that came from. My introduction to the fire service came about maybe 7 years ago. We put my son down to bed and didn't realize that he had an ear infection. And we didn't realize that that ear infection had developed into a fever. And nobody tells you when you're a brand new parent that like febrile seizures are a thing. So
yeah,
my wife heard a weird noise, as moms do, on the baby monitor and said, I better go check this out. And he was in the middle of a febrile seizure and had spit up a little bit and was, you know, going hypoxic and not a good evening. So we called 911 because at that point, you know, I'm an IT guy. I don't really have a lot of skills as far as medical goes. And firefighters were the first ones through the door. And I remember being told on my first day by our training officer then, Norm, rest in peace. He said that being a first responder is the only job in the world where a parent will hand you their baby. And I was that parent, like panicked, you know, and everything's all good now. My son, John, is 10 years old and telling me all the things that he knows. You know what I'm saying? But
it's a good spot to be in.
Yeah, it's all good now. But that day started my entrance into like, wow, wouldn't that be amazing to go do that? Like to go be on the team that shows up and goes through people's doors and does that kind of thing. And I can tell you from personal experience, being on the other side of that call, that I was desperately wishing. And that's the words that I use over and over as far as messaging goes toward this premise, the heroic ideal, the premise of that idea, is that people are desperately wishing. And what does that look like? That means shaking and crying and praying and desperately, please, God, send me someone who's strong enough, who knows what they're doing, who's prepared, who can think, because I couldn't think at that moment, you know? And I think that's one of three standards that we have to meet up to. Okay, so this is a part of a program that I'm putting together called the Heroic Ideal. I just delivered this through our department to all of our leadership, kind of like a leadership workshop on personal development kind of thing. So I say the first standard that you need to measure up to is the standard that's presented to you when you look in the mirror. And my argument there is that you know for certain, you do know whether or not you're measuring up, whether or not you're on the path, or whether or not there's things you need to be doing or focusing on or stopping if you spend enough time looking at yourself in the mirror. And the second standard is the measurement that our crew gives us. And this is where it kind of gets wishy-washy a little bit, because people get hung up on this premise that, well, I don't control what they think of me. Yeah, you're right. You don't control what they think of you, right? So it's like, you know, if somebody wasn't spending as much time in the gym as they could be, I might say, you know, it's not my job to follow behind you and smack cupcakes out of your hand. That's on you, right? But aside from that, I'm going to have my opinion of that. Whether that makes you feel uncomfortable or not, it doesn't really matter to me. It's the truth. And the last standard is the standard held by people that we serve. Okay, so the thinking on that and maybe the philosophy behind that generated this premise that people actually expect you to be a hero. How do I know that? Well, go look up any news brief about any first responder who did anything awesome, right? And pretty much instantaneously, the people running the news brief and the people who are getting interviewed call them heroes. When I presented this to our station or to our department leadership, I got called on that. And one of the chiefs said, well, that's all fine and well, but we don't think they're heroes. They're just doing their job. That's what they're supposed to do. He said, with all due respect, the traumatic situation that you lived through with your son having a febrile seizure, for the guy showing up, was just another medical call. I said, that's right. Yeah, that's right. That's the way you think about it. But that's not the way I thought about it. And that's what people are missing, is it doesn't matter what you think about it. They expect you to be a hero. So on the website, 6feet.ca, little self plug there, I wrote this keystone article, which basically anchors and centers all of my work. Okay, that this is the heroic ideal is what I'm trying to articulate, and very specifically so that I can fall back on this is what I'm talking about. And very recently, I had an idea for maybe a second part to this, because this explains the what. It explains like what the heroic ideal is, but not the moral imperative. This is like,
ooh, more like that.
Yeah, it's kind of like more prescriptive, right? That this is like, yeah. Well, here's what exists, but why should you adopt this is the second part, right? So here's the paragraph that I bring up in this leadership program to describe what the heroic ideal is. This is straight off the article. After the written tests, fitness evaluations, psychological exams, and peer reviews, you're measured ultimately by one additional standard. Despite what may be possible, they desperately wish you'll have the fortitude, durability, and passion to help every single time they call. The ideal you're expected to attain is almost impossible. The archetype we're expected to reach for includes the following concurrent characteristics: problem-solving ability within razor-thin timelines in such a way that life safety and property conservation are prioritized, mental toughness to preserve operational capacity, physical fitness that enables strength, endurance, power, and speed benchmarked against athletes, personal grit derived from experiences that demand perseverance, emotional intelligence that offers real compassion, understanding, and empathy, and skill honed from diligent training, all at the same time, all the time.
Man, cue the crowd noises again. Man, that is that is so heavy, and that is so, so huge. I mean, just...
I'm a wee bit passionate about this one, brother.
Yeah, but we need to be listening to this every day on the way to work, because that, I mean, there's you signed up to do this, and there's a moral imperative to be that individual that you, I mean, you yourself experienced. I don't want to use the word a victim, but as our community expects, you know, they make a call. I have a problem. Guys show up to fix this problem. Yeah. Not judge me for having the problem. Not reprioritize my problem for me. No, fix my problem. Fix my problem. In your case, your problem was your son. I would have been shitting all over myself too. Something would have happened to my son. And get you choked up if you're not careful.
Yeah.
I love in that same article this kind of the way that you knock the first responder off the pedestal, in the sense of, because that's what happens to us sometimes, right? You get put up on the stool, you're called a hero, and like, no, I'm not a hero, it's just my job, blah, blah, blah. But for those who are called, they only need the calling.
That's right.
Right. They only need the calling. I love this. Can you unpack that some more for us? Because in this current environment, this 2024 environment, being in the first responder business, and I think it's the same for you guys as it is for us, there's a lot to get distracted about, a lot to I would say entitlements. It's like my dad told me when I was getting into the job. He's like, you want to get paid, go be a nurse. You want to do this, and this is what you want to do, then please go to paramedic school. You know, if this is what you want to do, this is what you feel like you're called to do. What does that feel like to be that individual? Like, because you felt that call and you felt that calling, and that's all you need to keep going. What is that? Unpack that for us. What is that? How does that keep you going? What is that? What is the motivation there?
Wow. So, okay. So, you know, in case there's somebody listening who doesn't really align with fire stuff, there's a team at every structure fire called the RIT team, right? The rapid intervention team. So if a firefighter goes down, the RIT team is called in, right? And the way that I describe that responsibility is not only to the firefighter who goes down, but it's also a promise I make every single time I get on the truck. Every time I might say, in my example, because I'm a volunteer, right? I have a pager. Every time I charge my pager, I promise all of the people at my station and their families, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure they go home. Everything. And so what that means is I get up usually like 5:30 or so. So I'm not, you know, it's not crazy. I got to get up at 5:30 because my wife's got to work out. I got to work out. Somebody's got to take the dog for a walk. We got to make lunches. Got to do all these things. You know, that's not the egregious 3:30 a.m. David Goggins yelling, running down the street kind of thing. But there's nobody standing at the edge of my bed pleading for me to get up and go work out. You know, there's nobody tonight. Let's look, for example, tonight. You know, it's 8:21 on a Saturday night for a long weekend up here in Ontario. You know, so I'm not saying this to blow smoke, but it is what it is. My wife was out doing groceries today and said, do we need snacks? And that's a pretty easy opportunity to be like, yeah, bring home some Doritos. But I try my best. Okay. That's, I think when some people talk about what their best is, right? Like what is your actual best? To try your best to be the person who can reliably get on the truck and go do the job, right? And I don't think that necessarily requires an applause, okay? Because I find sometimes, especially in the volunteer service, I can bump into people who are more interested in getting a fire rescue t-shirt than they are throwing ladders and doing the dismal, you know, sweeping up after a car crash, or mm-hmm. or better than that. Here's a one-to-one example I think you could cross over with. There's a bunch of things you can do on emergency scenes that are unnecessary, but are nonetheless aimed toward the highest possible good. Okay, so take, for example, now this is coming from a social service worker. I'm a men's mental health counselor. So as far as, you know, emotional intelligence goes, you know, I can be kind of tuned into that a little bit more than maybe the regular person, because I counsel people. I talk to people about their feelings.
Sure.
So we go to a medical and it's not terribly troubling or traumatic. It looked like the person was going to make it, but the person's family member was at the edge of the driveway while they were being loaded up into an ambulance. And I could see from their expression that, you know, that is troubling. That is terrible for that person. I've been there. That sucks. You don't want to watch your people getting loaded into an ambulance. So I said, you know, you actually don't have to stand here and watch that if you don't want to. You can come over here and just stand here with me if you want. And I think it's like that kind of thing. It's like the extra 2% maybe, right? That would I be capable of doing that if my finances weren't handled? If I wasn't doing what I could do to make sure my job was okay? If I wasn't getting after it in the gym? If I didn't manage my diet in such a way that my guts weren't upset all the time? Right. And if I had a decent relationship with the people like living with me at home, right? All these different elements make up your ability to get on the truck over and over and over again. And I think it's like, for the people who recognize let's put it like this. Okay. When my wife was like 6 years old, you said to her, what are you going to do when you're going to be an adult? She said, I'm going to be a teacher. And now she's a teacher. She was one of those people who was she had it figured out. I figured it out when I was like 31. I was like, oh, they came through the door. They solved the problem. After everything was all fixed, I was like, oh, I need to get my shit together and go do that specifically. Like, that's an option here in the world of all the different things you can do. You can be the guy who goes and, you know, I always say steers into the waves despite the storm, you know? So I think, like, as far as being called goes, you know it. You know, it's like looking at yourself in the mirror and just recognizing, like, ugh, you know, like last night I did it again. Whatever it is for you. People have different it's that they're trying not to do. But they're like, man, last night I did it again. I know I'm better than that. You know, and it's like the voice in your head and your heart and your soul that says it. It says the same thing about being on the truck.
Yeah. You know, when you were talking about the standards, you reminded me of that, is it Burkowski poem, the guy in the glass? You know, when you think that everyone, the whole world is clapping their hands for you and saying, you know, what a great thing you are, what a great person you're doing, why don't you look in the mirror and see what the guy in the glass has to say about that. And it speaks to all those things that you were talking about. Are you doing what you're supposed to be doing? Are your finances squared away? Is your diet squared away? Which I will say, in your best, you can still screw up your guts in the best pursuit of,
oh yeah, of eating healthy. But it's like all things, right? It's moderation in all things, including moderation.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I was just making a joke. Like, you can eat a bad tomato and that mess your guts up.
Oh, that too. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Man. Go ahead.
So I wanted to bounce back to that heroic ideal stuff real quick, because I had a question about point two where you were worried about what the crew thinks of you. And I agree very strongly with everything else you said this entire time. But in my experience as a lieutenant and then a captain in a major EMS agency, and in my learning of 10 years going through therapy, I don't think there's anything more toxic than worrying about what people think of you. I mean, the reality is, if you're doing your job right and you're delivering the expectations of that department, meeting the needs of the patient, treating your people correctly, they're going to think highly of you.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I worry that that thought process can lead people to obsessing over what others think. And I don't think that's healthy at all.
Can I elaborate a little bit on that then?
Yeah, please.
Okay. So, very, very crucially, and you have to forgive me, I'm tapping into like counselor brain now, cause I, you know, it's how my brain works. But, I never said and wouldn't say that somebody should be worried about what their crew thinks. It's actually on the other side. Because I could do everything that I think is reasonable to try to appease somebody, and they might just not like me. Like, it might just work out like that, that, you know, they don't like me for whatever reason. I'm kind of suggesting on the other side, right? So it's less about worrying about what the crew thinks of me and more about the promise I make to my crew. So it's like when I say, I'm going to show up at my station when there's a call or when there's a practice, I'm going to be in the best possible way to show up for my crew as possible. Now, whether or not they take that and those efforts and that time and, you know, everything I'm trying to do, let's say for them as a net positive, isn't really on me. It's on them. But I can take complete ownership of my own readiness when it comes to serving my crew. You see what I'm saying? So it's like on the other side.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that word ownership is so important because we all need to have ownership over our, I mean, every aspect of this, right? Mm-hmm. You know, our mentalities, our actions, our words, all of that. And I think that clarifies that for me. It's just, yeah. I guess my perception of what you were saying didn't quite catch up with what you meant.
It sounds like, Bill, what you were talking about was trust, right? Like when I'm there, or whoever, you know, when I'm there, the crew can trust that I've got me squared away.
Sure.
That they're not gonna have to worry about, oh man, I gotta go do this thing because I know you're not gonna do it, or I've gotta go pick this thing up because I know you can't do it, or I gotta throw the ladder, I gotta do these things because I know you can't do it. You're talking about that from a perspective of, you know, the crew doesn't have to worry about me.
Yeah, it's even in saying that, it's more saying like, because even that's not on you, that's still on them, right? And
true.
They still have the opportunity to be like, well, despite all the things he's doing, blah, 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 blah. Well,
he forgot to take out the trash, piece of shit.
That's great for him, but he's still not doing this. You know, this is more like, this is a measurement of you, you, and you. I'm going to show up for me. I'm going to show up in the best possible way that I can for my crew, whether or not they can digest that or it metabolizes for them in such a way that's positive for the team is on them. But I'm going to show up here when I come through the door 100% for the team. And last, 100% for the people on the other side of the truck. You know what I mean?
Check. Yeah. Oh, man, I love it. That, it loosely connects to kind of the next point I wanted to talk about, which was the your blog or the blog post that's on 6 Feet on the badge, mm-hmm. right? And this came from Josh Chase, right? The from the Jump Seat Leadership
mm-hmm.
Group. And guys, if you haven't read that book yet, and you're not checking that page out, please do yourself a favor. Yeah, check that stuff out. It is straight up solid, and it brings home a lot of fantastic points that we in this community, wherever you're at in the world, I think we conflate a few things of titles and rank with leadership or the lack thereof.
Yeah,
of, oh, well, I'm not in charge of anything, so I'm not responsible for X, Y, Z. And no. I would argue that the tailboards and the jump seats are where some of the best and the most capable leaders live. But it talks about the badge, and it talks about how they had the badge, so you made it, right? You got the job. That's just an accomplishment. It doesn't actually entitle you to anything except an opportunity to. I don't want to use the word entitlement and opportunity in the same sentence, but all it guarantees you is an opportunity to prove what that badge actually means, right? And we're talking about service here, right?
Yeah.
Kind of get into that with us. And so what does that mean? So if I'm not entitled to anything that comes with that badge, I'm only entitled to an opportunity to serve. So what does that look like? What is, you've talked about it a little bit, and I'm probably screwing this question up.
No, I got you.
God, it's killing me.
I'll give you a one-on-one here. So the way it works, recruitment, the way it works at my department is a pretty, you know, prototypical, like write a test, do an interview, do a physical, that kind of stuff. But as well, at the station level, there's like an open house. And so you go and kind of mix and mingle in the apparatus bay with a couple people from the station where they kind of, you know, see if there's a fit kind of thing. It maybe lasts about an hour. They ask a couple questions. You can ask them a couple questions. It's really just like a surface level poke of the person. And when I went, I was in a room with maybe 8 or 9 other candidates. And I felt, well, I'll give you the what actually happened. I was standing there and, okay, these 3 people went down to Texas. These 3 people came from the local community college. These 2 people did their pre-service 10 years ago and they're full-time firefighters. And I was like, hey, I'm Bill. I fix computers. Like I had no, you know, like no, I felt like I had no reason to be in the room with all these people. And the one-to-one here is when I got back in my truck after that open house, I actually called my mom. And I was like, well, that's a wrap on that idea because like there's no way. Like, what are they? I just figured, what could I possibly bring to, you know, in the face of all these different people? Now, a couple years on, I feel and felt certainly this echoed incredibly intensely for me when I first started. I felt like the department took a chance on me. And I feel like that sort of mindset might bleed over well for some folks to be like, obviously I hit whatever, you know, check boxes they were looking for. So it's not like, you know, they went out on some crazy plank to say, well, let's just give this guy a shot or something like that. But certainly in a room full of people that were super, super skilled already, I felt like I had to earn my keep. And so I approached my first year certainly like that, well above and ahead with that mindset. But certainly still, when I see stuff come down or like, you know, volunteer fire, right? So we're going to go do like a fundraiser or something like that or something comes up. Whenever that stuff comes up, you know, I kind of put my hand up because I'm like, well, that's why I'm here. Like, that's why I stepped forward, you know? And one thing I regurgitate over and over on Instagram is that nobody's forcing you to be here. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to do all this stuff, well, you can go home. Like, it's a small table for a reason kind of thing, you know? So, and that works with fit too, right? Like sometimes you just don't belong at the table. It's not that I'm trying to hurt anybody's feelings by saying that, but you know, there's a reason the circle's small, you know?
And it sounds like the ability and willingness to serve is what secures that seat at the table.
Yeah. I think, I think that blends a little bit into an idea I've been playing with recently about endurance, right? I'm talking all kinds of shit about endurance. By the way, I hope like cursing's on the show. I'm like throwing out a couple already.
But, should we tell him that I was responsible for the first explicit label on the podcast? Moose was there too.
Here's the thing, okay? you can serve, because you were saying the ability and willingness to. And I think there's a big, I think there's a big gap between those two ideas.
Yep. Yep.
Because I think service is predicated on endurance. Because if you can't keep doing it, that's kind of when your service ends. And maybe it changes. Maybe it goes into something different. But service, as you're defining it in the moment, capital S service, is hinged, I like to think, on your ability to be ready to continue doing it. So there's a difference between your will to serve and your ability to serve, right?
So you could almost rephrase it as capability and capacity.
Sure.
Right? Capable, willingness, capacity,
yeah.
Endurance.
Well, because it's like, okay. I might be like primed. I might be like ready to go. I can't wait to get out there, but I've got a torn calf.
Mm.
So it's like my ability to serve almost is like secondary to my will to serve, because I have to want to go out there and do it. I have to want to go to the station and help. I have to want to go to, you know, it's not like guys who are on shift and just go to all the calls that come in, right? I know for certain that this must happen to some degree. People listen to the pager and say, am I going to this one or not?
You know,
but your will to go no matter what is what lays at the foundation, the base. On top of that is all your ability, including your ability to serve.
Yeah, I was going to say almost endurance is the bridge between the two, but you say it actually more eloquently on your website as that endurance is the baseline of all action.
Because if you can't keep doing it, it doesn't matter. You can wish for whatever you want, but if you can't keep doing it, that's the only thing that matters is endurance.
And that's your hashtag, right? Gas tanks win fights.
That's it, man. Gas tanks win fights.
And not just physical ones, right? So we're talking mental and emotional ones too.
Yeah. I mean, that lesson to me was driven home in 2017. I did the GORUCK challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, the cadre responsible for that one, you know, long story short, they had us doing like sugar cookies on the beach. Right up until that moment in my life, I didn't even know what that meant. And, you know, doing all that stuff. And they said, who wants to be a team leader? Everybody looks at each other like, this is horrible. I have no idea what that means. So no. And they're like, okay, fine. Get back in the surf, get back in the sand. Second time they asked, who wants to be a team leader? I'm like, well, that probably means this stops at some point, so I'll do it. They were like, who's your assistant team leader? So I smacked the guy next to me. I was like, that guy is. You know, we had to go do this thing. We went and did the thing. And while we were doing it, I was kind of yelling at people, good job. You've trained for this. Like, let's keep pressing and whatever. And when I stopped, the team leader spot got sent to somebody else. And the cadre came over and said, why'd you stop encouraging people? I said, well, I'm not the team leader anymore. I didn't want to step in his toes or whatever. And he said, and you know, this 2017, man, this started the trajectory. He was like,
right.
Leadership happens from within the chain of command, not just from the top, you know,
boom.
That's that,
there it is.
The backseat, you know, tailboard kind of mentality. And that's, you know, the gas tanks win fights things comes from certainly with GORUCK. You don't get your patch unless you finish.
Right.
You know, and then, in jiu-jitsu, it's like every new person that starts with our club, unfortunately, I put them in a position called knee on belly, right? And if you're not, you know, used to jiu-jitsu or whatever, I basically lay you down on your back, stick my knee in your guts, and just drive that sucker down. And it's just like you can see the Mortal Kombat energy meter just going like, it's horrible. But it's the point is, like we teach two lessons in that position, right? It's that you can detect when you've almost had enough. And like, if I catch you looking at the clock, like when you're really heave breathing, and I catch you looking at the clock, that's when the gas tanks win fights things comes. Cause I'm like, yo, turn towards me. The fight's not done yet. I'm not done.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And second to that, it's like this, we have this idea of turn your hips towards the fight, right? The way you get rid of knee on belly is by turning toward the guy. So what would it be like to do that off the mats where it matters most? You know, gas tanks been fucked, man. I'm huge on that idea. It's game changer.
I'm just glad that somebody's bringing up jujitsu and it's not me, because I feel like the rest of the group is like, this guy's like a CrossFit vegan jujitsu dude.
My man. Yeah.
I'm just really happy that somebody else brought up Neon Belly and I haven't even said it yet. So.
You gotta get these guys into it, man. It's a life changer.
I'm just worried I'll have to go up against Moose, and that's gonna hurt.
No, well, see, life changing for me too, right? So I did. You'll appreciate this, Bill. I was a dumbass and was transitioning from I was doing a chair set from twisting arm control, and I was facing someone that was way lighter than me, and tore my meniscus because I put weight on my ankle instead of where I should have been, which is my hip through their hip. Yep. And so I'm just now getting back into training, and life changing. I started in September of 2021, and it's hard to emphasize how much it was changing for me, not just from a physical fitness perspective, but from a mentality perspective. Quite frankly, I wonder how I worked as a paramedic without the training, because it's hard to remember a time now where I didn't, you know, and I'm brand new, right? I'm only a couple of years in. I'm brand new. But I appreciate what you say. I got a couple of questions for you. Have you read Principles by Ray Dalio?
No. I'm totally unfamiliar with that.
Yeah, so Ray Dalio, I guess, got famous for kind of accurately predicting the crash in 2008, but he talks about his company Bridgewater and what made them successful. And really, and I actually pulled it up just because I haven't read it in a couple of years, but everything you've been talking about really resonates with me and kind of reminds me of what he says. Hmm. And this idea of like radical transparency and radical truth, right? So, and I don't want to... I pulled up his website. I don't want to read the whole thing. But just real quick, it says, being radically truthful and transparent with your colleagues and expecting your colleagues to be the same with you ensures that important issues are apparent instead of hidden.
Mm-hmm.
It also enforces good behavior and good thinking, because when you have to explain yourself, everyone can openly assess the merits of your logic. If you are handling things well, radical transparency will make that clear. And if you are handling things badly, radical transparency will make that clear as well.
Mm.
So it helps to maintain high standards. And when you you know talk about integrity, and when you talk about like what I got from you, how you function as a leader, but how you function as a team manager. And I don't mean like a clerical manager. I mean like the Ted Lasso manager, right? Like, how do you manage a group of personalities that are very different from you and very different abilities than you do? And how do you collectively lead the group to success? So I don't have a question. I'm just more so a comment. The question I have is, you said gas tanks win battles, but also your efficiency of the gas tank usage,
mm-hmm.
right? So you're describing a newer person who completely tries to flail right out of that Neon Belly, and it sucks. I've been there. And instead of trying to do the shrimp out or do whatever, try to efficiently get out. And when they don't get out, not freak out. What does Jocko say in, Gracie, he does the first part of, Hicks and Gracie's book, and he talks about becoming comfortable in bad situations.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that translate to what you're describing, not only in the fire service, but in the professional setting? How do you ensure that not only do you're building a resilient gas tank, but you're also using your energy efficiently?
Sure. So, you're right. When I stick somebody in Neon Belly, for the first 3 minutes of their jiu-jitsu experience, they flail around because they don't know what to do. They don't speak the language and they haven't built that kind of gas tank. You must hear it all the time. People come through and they're like, oh yeah, I run. Yeah, I run. I ruck. I lift weights, whatever. It's not the same. It's not fight cardio. It's different, you know? And, you're right as well when you say that those people haven't learned how to develop efficiency yet. So then maybe there's a separate gas tank. It's on and off the mats. Because when they go home and they have to negotiate that part of their ego on, I say the quiet car ride home, right? Because I've been there too, where I can't even listen to the radio. I just got stomped Like my soul just got snatched out of my body by a 130-pound man, you know, and they have to reconcile all these different things that have never happened before and come back. Right. And so that's the thing I'm looking for. I know they don't know jujitsu. I know they don't know the escapes. They don't know how to maximize, you know, what little gas tank they do have on the mats. But when they come back, I'll give you how this works in our gym. We have like a, you know, like a biker cut on their vest, you know, like the top rocker, bottom rocker. So we have a top rocker that says 6 feet, and you only get that by showing up, because you can buy a white belt. Everybody says, like, you know, the white belt's the first belt that you own, or sorry, it's the first belt that you earn or whatever. I'm like, yo, you can buy a white belt on Amazon, but you only get this rocker by showing up. Right. And so it, sometimes for some people, it's like three times, because I know how hard it is for them to be like, I'm going to show up. For other people, you know, it might be six or seven times, but so that's one of the ways that I reinforce that. But professional side, yeah, it's well, I can speak to that too. Over the last maybe 4 weeks or so, you were saying about radical transparency. So I own a IT company, and on January 22nd, we had a colossal infrastructure failure affecting thousands of users. And that spanned about 8 days where we were absolutely hemorrhaging money to try and stop this problem from happening. That ended by way of my migrating all of those users to a new platform that I paid for, because we couldn't solve the problem. All the layers of redundancy that I had set up in place to prevent this from happening failed one after another. And we actually had a conversation within our organization to the tune of some people saying, well, let's just tell them it'll be fixed in 2 days. The pressure that I was putting on us as an organization for messaging was, we're going to tell the truth about every single question. And if they don't like it, that's fine. If they're angry, that's fine. But, you know, my buddy Ben always says, nobody will blame you for telling the truth. You know, and so that carries over in fire too, right? Like when I first started, another thing I think brand new firefighters could do well to adopt. I used to ask people, like, straight up, I'd say, hey, when we get back to the hall, can you give me some feedback? I've never used a fire hose on a real fire before. That was friggin' wild. Can you tell me if I did it okay? You know, I had never done CPR on a person before, you know, not just a CPR dummy. So I would go to somebody like who was in a position of junior leadership and say, did that work out okay? If it didn't work out okay, can you tell me about that so that at least I can do something about it on the back end? You know,
I gotta ask a follow up. So,
yeah,
because I certainly appreciate it. I love like what you're saying here. It's not pushing back. It's maybe exploring more.
Sure.
What
yeah,
you're
yeah,
saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly the person that comes back, after getting smashed every round for a half hour rolling, right.
Yep.
There's something in them that, makes them want to come back. Right.
Yep.
Or maybe, you know, whatever professional, surrogate example you want to use, whatever.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
But we're capturing a certain subset of people, but we're also missing people that could be just as good. Right. How do we create an environment where we can be radically honest with people? Right. But also cultivate the folks that we're missing, because certainly I would say that those folks have background experience that are going to make our team more robust and more effective. But they might have other, I don't know, who knows, any number of reasons. Right. Some people are just not going to come back. Right. That's sure. The reality. Some people are just not going to come back. What's Tyson saying? Everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the mouth.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But I feel like we're missing a subset of people that we are not going to have the most effective team if we lose these people. Number one, you can just tell me to pound sand if you disagree. And if you don't, then I just want to get your thoughts on that.
Sure. I'm interested in one percenters. So where that comes from is my comment earlier. It's a small circle, man. Some people ain't going to fit in. And if that means I have to lose out on maybe a 70%, hitter, I'm kind of okay with that. And in some circles, right? So when it comes to building out a jiu-jitsu team, I'm 100% okay with that. If you don't want to come back, you don't belong here. That's what it is. When it comes to hiring for an IT company, different story, because it's a different context. You know, if take for example, one time, I always think about this girl. I was interviewing for a new position we were hiring, and she came in, sat down, and the baseline introductory question. I said, "Hey, how are you? Tell me a little bit about yourself." And she started crying, and I was like, "Oh my God!" Like I wasn't trying to upset you or anything like that. Like I was just trying to start a conversation here. I hope everything's going okay. And so toward what you're saying, I wonder what that person who interviews just horribly and that specific situation just doesn't lend well to their personality, what they could have brought to the team. Sure.
Okay. So I think you just said the opposite of what you said before, right? So in one sense, so I guess you're saying it's circumstantial.
It's context right? driven. Yeah, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. Cause I would, if you were to say that you were only a one percenter, I would vehemently disagree with you, mm-hmm. but I see where you're coming from. Ken and I were talking about this earlier, right? We are suffering in every first responder field, mm-hmm. right? We do not have the luxury of one percenters.
Yeah.
We don't. We can certainly cultivate and try our best to create the one percenter like you're talking about. I was actually talking to somebody else today, certainly emergency responders, the field of emergency response is not for everyone. But we can do better as organizations. We can do better as leaders to cultivate folks to be a more conducive team environment. But I also agree with you that sometimes it's just time to push through the door.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. And certainly there are situations like that, but we can add as many barriers as possible as leaders, because if we're taking ownership, right, if we're taking true ownership, every time that person leaves, right, a part of it, maybe we could have done better. That's how That's how I take radical ownership, right? Even if it's a mind game, right? Even like how Jocko says, sometimes it is a mind game. Sometimes it truly is not your fault. But if you follow that radical ownership mentality, certainly it's a vehicle to optimizing yourself and your leadership method. So. I think I agree with you.
You could take it a step further, Moose, and tie both of them together really, really well in that, to your point, Moose, not in the industry, we don't there. And even in the air medical side of things, we're not settling for folks that we never would have settled for before. But now instead of looking at who's the one percenter right now that deserves to be here, that's what you were looking for 5 years ago. Nowadays, you're looking for, who has the capacity mm-hmm. to learn what it is we have to teach them to make them, in short, a period of time, that one percenter that we need, right? And that's where, to your point, Moose, that's where the leadership and ownership piece of it comes from, because you can't go, all right, we hired this dude and they suck. You can't do that, right? You hire the person, you've invited this person onto your team. Well, now you have a responsibility to that individual to make them successful within their capacity, right? Now you could beat the dead horse if you want to and hope for that 1% term merge that just doesn't have it. That's where programs like what you were talking about before, Bill, where some of those initial entry trainings do involve things like sugar cookies. And for the uninitiated, that's where you go get really, really wet. And then you get out and you get sand in everywhere. And I mean everywhere.
Because, you know, I can't help but think of an example I had where I was working. There was a paramedic who had gone through multiple field trainers, right? And the guy was on his last leg. And everyone had written this person off. And as a last resort, I was asked to work with this individual. So what did I do? I took a completely different, like, I don't know what they did, honestly. I did every day. We came in, we checked the truck, and then we went upstairs to the classroom and we hammered something, whatever that was. And I took an intensive different approach. And that person still works for that agency, right? Years later, where he would have been fired. Now, in a textbook 1% leadership scenario, we would just write him off. Right. The guy's gone. And how many from an operational standpoint, how many overtime hours would have had to have been made up that would have cost the agency? Right. How what would have been the cost of all the people that then he has trained that then would have been lost? Right. But I really get where you're coming from, Cody, as well. I had another question and then I lost my train of thought. So that's fine.
I get what you're saying, too. And I think that's why it's context driven. You know, there's some situations where my family doesn't want a 70 percenter. My family wants a 1%er. But then there's other situations where it's completely reasonable, completely rational to accept somebody who's trainable, you know, and then you bring them up to whatever standard that you're trying to achieve.
Because we've seen all kinds of first round draft picks that flopped. And we saw all kinds of six-round draft picks that became goats.
Sure.
You know,
the slow boil, right?
Yeah.
There's actual data for that stuff, Moose. there's a guy named Brian Decker. He was a Green Beret in the military, and he was put in charge of all of the assessment selection training for Army Special Forces, you know, the Green Berets. And they looked at him and they said, hey, listen, we've got a 70% pass rate on assessment selection, but only, and I think it was like 30% of these dudes are actually making it to a team. So they're not making it all the way through the training pipeline. And he went through and he looked at these folks, and he had something like, was it 1200 data points that he was looking at per each individual candidate, and was, without getting into a whole nother podcast on this stuff, but he had basically discovered that there was character issues. Right. The character of the individual was what ultimately made them successful or not successful, or trainable versus not trainable. The theory was, you know, I could train you to do more pull-ups and more push-ups and run faster. You could physically train the body to do that, but you can't make a team guy out of somebody that's not a team guy to begin with. Right. And to take it a step further. So then he went on to the Browns in the NFL. So the NFL picks this guy up and goes, well, we're going to fix our recruiting problem real quick. So he goes from the Browns to the Colts, and he does the same thing. And he finds out that 50% of first round draft picks never make it through their first season. It's like, I was floored when I read this. I was like, that's insane. So these mega talented guys are getting mega millions. And I'm just a paramedic, but you know, they're getting these mega millions, and to not even make it to the big show past their first year, that's their rookie season. That's a learning year. You didn't even make it out of the kindergarten of the NFL. And it comes down to character issues of what kind of adversity have they had to overcome, and how the money changes them, and all of those other things. But the data point was 50% of first round draft picks don't actually make it out of their first season. So when we go after I started getting real leery of that first round draft pick, that one that was like, oh man, we got to have this guy. They're just that good. We got to have him on the team, only to find out on the back end of it that, oh, there's a character problem here that I now have to manage out of the organization. Mm. It's a nightmare from a leadership perspective. And you can only take so much ownership for that, right? You can only train, counsel, coach, mentor until you've now reached the point where you have to make that therapeutic extraction.
And I mean, that attention itself can be toxic too, right? So like that attention then might cause this like loop, right? Where you're like, they'll start believing, oh, I am really the shit. And maybe I don't need to do that extra rep. Maybe I can let off the gas a little bit.
But that's a character thing too, right?
Exactly, yeah. Well, it's a character thing, but also I'd say it's also lapsing into human nature though, right? Like, there's a general path that everyone wants to take towards not disorder, but just relaxing, right? What Jocko says, like, he wants to sleep in every night, you know, who or every morning, right? You know who's terrible at waking up early? I am, right? But it's a battle every day that I don't win, right? Somehow Jocko wins it every day. I don't. You start wanting to relax a bit and you start believing that, oh, maybe, you know, maybe you don't even realize, oh, that you're doing it. But you know who's not taking that break? The guy who's projected to go last, right? The guy who's projected to go last, I guarantee you, is doing that extra rep. And I guarantee you taking the extra rep, running the extra mile. And how does this translate to EMS? How does this translate to, any first responder? Listen, I went to a shift today, and on my way to work, I'm thinking protocols, right? I'm thinking, okay, if I see this, what can I do? And I'm not perfect, right? I have lazy moments. When you talk about character issues, I got a bunch of them, right? I'm a poster child for character flaws. That being said, you have to take ownership of those, and it's a daily battle. And sometimes you're gonna lose. You just gotta be okay with you can't be really okay with losing, because then that's a slippery slope. But you gotta be okay with getting back up.
You have to be okay with it though. Because exactly, yeah. It's something that Bill says, losing is the process of endurance.
I guess that's not the best. Like, what I was trying to say, I was really trying to say that you can't become comfortable with losing. I guess maybe that's
You can't accept it. Right? Can't don't accept it.
Yeah.
You can't accept it. But what? Unpack that for us, Bill. What is what? So help these folks get their heads around losing as the process of endurance, right?
Yeah, sure.
How do you go from being the sugar cookie and continuing on through those challenges, whether it be a literal, you're covered in sand and everything, or a professional or an emotional setting, you know, how do you endure? How do you lose, bounce back, lose, bounce back, lose and bounce back? How do you do that?
So I think endurance is a skill, and I think it's something you can sign up for. And I think well, it is though. I mean, like, you can just go sign up for a marathon if you want to. And then
sure.
Like that's the functional format of endurance. It sucks after about 20 kilometers. It sucks the whole time. You know? And so it's something that you can practice. It's something that's actionable. So that means you can sign up for an obstacle course race like Tough Mudder, or you can go sign up for extra responsibilities at the fire hall, or you can 6.5 feet outside this door. My basement bathroom is all gutted right now because I started the reno, because I told my wife I was going to, you know, reno this bathroom. I know nothing about renoing bathrooms, but I'm going to screw it up over and over and over again until it looks like a bathroom, you know? And I think that the process of losing is going, okay, when I started knocking a hole on the inside wall of the bathroom, I actually told my son, who was helping me do it, now, son, we got to be very careful that we don't go through this hole into the other hole, because then we're going to have to replace the wall in the laundry room too. And it turns out we're replacing the wall in the laundry room too. Because dad's
a good thing, you know, a drywall guy.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Mark will be doing the wall in the laundry room. You know, but it was like swinging the sledgehammer. I put it through the wall and went through the other wall. And I went, okay, well, I just screwed that up. And so now I'm going to do that too, I guess. You know, so I think the trouble is losing is scary. And losing, it's not only scary, but it hurts. And it sucks, and it can affect your personal worth if you lose often enough without like a win in between. You know, so I think that plays upon, you know, if we're going to look at losing as the process of building endurance, that means on the other side of that, you have to plan the same way that we plan to lose in order to build endurance. We have to also plan to look for, you know, attainable wins so that when we win, we can build up that foundation so that the foundation gets strong enough and tall enough that when we lose, it's not earth shattering. It's like, okay, well, I lost again. So now I'm just going to get back at it and keep doing what I know I do, which is stay in the fight, turn my hips toward the fight, and get some action here.
Yeah, it's there's some Stoic philosophy in there, right?
Yeah.
Losing is an assault on your ego.
Yeah, big time.
Right. I've knocked a hole. Like, I'm the worst. I'm almost banned from doing home projects because that one hole is like, son of a bitch, and I throw the hammer the other way,
yeah,
and then there's a hole in that wall too, and I broke the hammer.
Yeah,
right. So it's just, and you're just, I'm like, I'm an idiot. I'm a fucking Neanderthal doing this stuff. So it's an assault on your ego. And the trick is, correct me if I'm wrong, so the trick is to detach the loss from your identity. And saying, look, all I did was lose. That does not make me a loser. All I did was fail. I am not a failure. And yeah. And pull apart the lesson. You know, like Tim Grover says, and I've been saying this for a couple of weeks now, of like, when you lose, don't jump right back up. Stay down there for a minute.
Oh, feel it.
Figure it out.
Feel it.
Feel it.
Yep.
Feel it. Figure it out. Figure out why you lost. Figure out what decision it was that you made. And then get up and start training and then start winning, right? So the second you get up and you start moving forward,
yeah,
that's where the wins are starting to happen.
Yeah, because big feelings are there for a reason, right? So like, if you just ignore the big feelings and you're like, oh, I'm a winner and whatever, and you go and just try to attack again, well, you're just kind of like stuffing all them down, and everybody knows what happens when you do that, right? When you're saying like,
yeah,
you know, pulling things apart and looking at it like that. So, you know, if this was like a counseling thing, I would say that, you know, everybody can sometimes have these automatic thoughts, right? And that's what pops into your brain. You don't have any control over it. It just materializes in your brain. And so like, say if you put a hole through the one wall and then threw the hammer and the hammer broke, you'd be like, of course the hammer broke. I always break the hammer. I always break the hammer because I'm an idiot. And that's like how the automatic thought comes up. You know, in a counseling setting, I would ask somebody to try to take something like that. And let's just look at it outside of this feeling and just like kind of massage it a little bit and say like, well, where's that coming from? Ask a couple questions. Like, you know, if my best friend came and said to me, I always break the hammer because I'm an idiot, what might you say to them? And how might that be different from what you're saying to yourself? You know, that kind of thing. But that process of losing, I mean, that just gets hammered home through jujitsu, man. Because think about this. You want to talk about ego. How about, you know, we got a friend who rolls around here called Little Josh, because there's multiple Joshes, you see. You know, and so Little Josh, in quite possibly the most emasculating way possible, is named such because he's like 130 pounds. You know, and so when that guy gets on top of you and strangles you, the way that you make that stop is by submitting to him, right? So the act, literally, do you want to talk about ego, of tapping out, saying, I can't help myself. Please stop. Don't kill me. Right. I submit to him. So that's something you get to practice. We always say we practice hard feelings on the mat so we know what to do with them in real life.
But there's another side to that.
Ooh.
But there's another side to that, right? So one of the things that my coaches, like, that he taught me, and like something we do in my gym, is if they get you immediately, right, you try to reverse, right? And you see, okay, what happened that I got into that position? And it's an immediate teachable moment. So it's a yin and a yang, right? You have to be able to, like one party has to be able to let go of their ego, but the other party has to be forthcoming in that teaching, right?
Yeah.
I really like the thing that you said earlier about, I don't know. The thing that I interpreted it as was you got to just do, right? You got to produce. And I think it's Linchpin by Seth Godin that talks about you just got to do. You can't let perfect be the enemy of good, right? I'm pretty sure you got to just produce, right? And it's not going to be perfect, right? Like, just like you said, you're going to figure it out. I bought a Land Cruiser. I don't know. I mean, my dad was a mechanic. I don't know how to work on cars, right?
Solid. But I love it.
Figuring it out.
I like that energy. Yeah. I just like that. Yeah. That like, yeah, yeah, we're moving and shaking, man. I bought a car. I'm going to learn how to fix it. Let's go.
Dude, this podcast was a thing where I wasn't a podcaster, right? Ken wasn't a podcaster. The medical director that was with us at the time was not, but we just decided to go for it.
Yeah.
Right. And we did it. And now, God, Ken, how long have we been doing? At least 6 years? No, not 6 years. Yeah, 6 years.
Yeah, right? 2018, 2019, something like that.
We're still now just doing it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not what you don't really think about. Honestly, you don't even look up or anything. You just continue to produce. And sometimes you take a step back as a leader and you say, okay, how's my team doing? Is my team okay? Okay, my team's good. All right, let's keep moving. Right?
Yeah.
You got to just do the thing. And the other thing I just want to say is don't fucking talk about it. Don't be a talker and don't produce, right? I can't stand that.
Don't be a try baby.
My thing is don't talk about something and ever, but if you're going to talk about it, maybe say something after you've produced for a while. Yeah. Right? Like, I don't know.
Because then it's like the proof's in the pudding. I can talk about it because I've been there. I've done it.
It's self-evident.
Yes.
Words are not necessary. You know, it's self-evident. Yeah.
That just do it attitude. So I run these like groups with 6 feet where we, you know, just work on getting people to set goals correctly and do some like a little bit of deep work and go out there and get after it. And I like when you're saying, I went and bought this car, I'm going to work on it. I just like being around people who are doing stuff because it's like fuel to me. I'm like, yeah, let's get out there. And like just make stuff happen. We're looking at doing a group in June that's going to end off with like an in-person. See, I don't even know what it is yet. It's like going to be like a workshop or a 24-hour thing. It's like I just kind of like put it out there to the universe. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do it. I have no idea how that's going to work yet. What insurance I got to get, the place we're going to do it, how we're going to feed people. Not worried about it. That's a future Bill problem. Fuck that guy. We're going to figure it out. You know what I mean?
Bingo.
Love it.
Man, that's a perfect thing to finish up on, too. I mean, Cody, go ahead, man.
No, I think that ties into that last point that I kind of teed you up for earlier was like on having building a community and a network and a system of support around you, but not just for you. You've built this network that the network can draw from as well. And how do you do that? How did you do that? And
so I got to tell you, I'm super, super stoked about what like 6 feet is materializing into. I'm not like planning it. It's just happening. And this comes from, and it's more focused now than it has been in the past because specifically, I've been hosting these groups where people get together and we talk about stuff. So I'll give you, so basically long story short, 2019 or so, I wrote this like goal setting program called The Wedge. And I wanted to run it with firefighters because I was like, I think there's some meat here and I kind of want to test it with humans and see if it works. Me and a couple buddies did it a bunch of times, but I was like, I want to see if it works. And it did. And I got some really cool feedback from it, from people who were saying, you know, this was impactful, this is meaningful, that kind of thing. And fast forward a little bit, that worked. So it was kind of in my brain, okay, we're going to somehow do stuff with other people on the internet. And those people are going to talk to each other. I don't know. We're just going to figure it out. Then I got a sponsorship thing where this company wanted to make a bunch of like ruck patches if I wrote a review about them and stuck it on the website. So I was like, dope. Absolutely. That's free ruck patches. Send me 40 ruck patches. I don't even know what I'm going to do with them yet. And then I like just thought up, I'm going to tell people if they go do a 12-mile ruck, I'll send them a patch. And then like all these people, all these maniacs on the internet were sending me like pictures of their watches and their routes and stuff doing the, some people started calling it the 6 feet 12 miler. So I was like, cool. Now we have this thing called the 6 feet 12 miler. And what I was finding was people who were doing the 12 miler were kind of like talking to each other. And so I was like, oh, okay. So there's now there's something about people who are out there getting after it, are kind of looking for people. We ended up finding a couple people in the same city who did it and then connecting them together. And then most recently, I ran one of these groups through January that was like, you know, goal setting and talking about personal development and that kind of thing. And I called it the Unchallenge because I saw a bunch of stuff coming up about, okay, every day in January, we're going to do 30 pushups a day, or we're going to do a couch to 5K for the month of January or whatever. And I was like, that's really cool, but it really only touches on like your ability to do pushups kind of, you know? So I was like, well, what else could we do over the period of 1 month? And I got together 50 people, which to me was like, I was like, holy crap, there's 50 people signed up for a challenge that has no posted prerequisites, no plan, no, like you might have to do this or you might have to do that. And they just signed up, good to go, join the WhatsApp group. And they were like, I'm down. Tell me what to do. And so we ended up doing, we ended up looking at 9 pillars of personal wellness and how those things impact the rest of your life. Like, what would it be like if you got your cognitive wellness under control and you started to understand, you know, the thought, feeling, and thinking triangle from CBT? And how could you take that and put that into your workouts and like just kind of throwing stuff against the wall? And this group turned into like, basically, if I can speak on it, kind of like group therapy, where people were identifying that like, this is an okay space for me to talk about things I'm dealing with. And then other people were like, you know, rah, rah, rah for that person, go get after it. And we planned a bunch of goals and we did a bunch of work. And alongside that, I would send out these taskings, right? It would just be like all capital letters, tasking, colon, run 10 kilometers before midnight tomorrow. No like rhyme or reason. That's just what it is. And then these maniacs would go do it and send me like their times and stuff. And man, I received like heart filling feedback about what some of these people have done since and some of the ways that they've gotten after it. One of the people from that group lives real close by and was looking for a jiu-jitsu gym. So I was like, yo, you should just roll here. You know, shout out to Meg. She's rolling here now from that group.
Nice.
And that got this idea about now we're going to bridge this to in-person. And I threw it out there and there's people from like Michigan and like Montreal and stuff saying, yeah, I'll fly in. I'll fly in and do it.
Michigan's basically Canada. Just
yeah, I know. But, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, I think the process has been organic and that's really important. I didn't try to like inject anything weird or like any big ego stuff. I was just like, okay, if you want a free patch, I'll ship it anywhere in the world. Go do a 12 mile ruck. And then that
flew. Yeah, that's not weird at all.
I know it's sort of weird, but you know, it just spawned, you know, and I just kind of, you know, well, here's how, okay, here's, instead of me trying to, you know, drop some trite stuff on you, I'm a faith-driven person. And I did this exercise with everybody in this group, the same way I do with every brand new counseling client that comes in, where we name and we define and we operationalize our core values. The same way it's important to name the feelings that you have, we name our core values. One of my core values is faith. And I define that personally as believing that good things will happen, even if I don't have evidence for it. Right. And that's how I kind of approach this. I just say, yo, if you're following what we're doing here and you kind of want to do something else like extra or like inside the circle kind of thing, get at me. It's free. We're a not-for-profit. And they just do it, you know? So I think, or like an organic approach has something to do with it. And I also think like You ever heard Jordan Peterson's argument for the highest possible good?
Yeah, I think it's been a little bit, but go ahead.
So this is kind of how I run 6 feet. We're aimed at the highest possible good, period. Okay, so that looks like something like this, okay? I want to aim at something that's good for me, net positive, in every possible way that it could be good for me personally. I also want to aim at something that's good for me, but good for the people in my life as well, like my family. You can't just do something, you know, that's awesome for you. Like, you know, I can't just go move to Alaska or something and be a fisherman. Like, it also has to be good for my family. So I also want to aim at something that's good for me, net positive for me, good for my family in every way, and maybe even good for my community. But the highest, because if we keep doing that, we keep stretching it out, the highest possible good, right, might be something that's good for me, something that's good for my family, something that's good for my community, and maybe for my country for the rest of recorded history. Maybe I could aim at something like that. So maybe I could aim at something like equipping first responders with actionable resilience skills that they can take back to their teams today for free forever. You know what I mean? And I think as long as you're driving towards that kind of thing, that'll keep you on a track. That's how I look at it anyway, personally.
I got to be honest with you, bro. For like the first 15 minutes, half hour, I was like, this guy's interesting, but I'm not sure I align with him. I just got to be honest with you. That little last bit that you just said, I certainly do align with you.
We got you, bro. Got him.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Got him. You know what I mean? No, seriously, though. The first part of what you were saying is you were moving forward into uncertainty, right? Into not knowing what's going to happen and kind of just trusting the system, not trusting the system, just trusting yourself. Maybe, you ever seen Jurassic Park? The guy, what's his name? Ian Malcolm says, life finds a way, right?
Yeah, man. Yeah.
The part that he doesn't talk about is you got to put in some effort though, and consistent effort. But once you do that, you're certainly going to fall. You're certainly going to mess up, but just still stay consistent. And, I appreciate what you're saying, man. And I align with you more so because I was thinking about how we started this thing, right? We started this thing because we saw, we wanted better patient outcomes and we wanted something that was free that people didn't have to pay money for. So that they could get good education that was not only impactful to their patient, but it was also impactful to them, right? And their wellness. So, I certainly appreciate what you're saying. And I certainly align with you. That's cool,
man. That was, I don't have words for it. That was such an incredible display of just like kind of what you said of just fuck it, let's give it a shot and let's see what
What's
happens.
What's the worst
here.
That's gonna happen? What's the worst?
Yeah. What's the worst? They're not going to do, they're not going to walk 12 miles with 35 pounds. Oh, God.
Yeah.
That's going to be a problem. I still owe you a 12 miler, by the way.
Yeah.
But. But hey, you guys have anything else for Mr. Bill?
No, thank you so much, Bill.
There's a quote from The Martian that is ringing in my head, but I don't want to mess it up. But basically, it says something along the lines of like, you know, when, and I'm going to mess it up. But basically, you know, when life gives you a shit sandwich, you can either let it be a shit sandwich or you can get the work.
Yeah. Effectively, right? Man. It's a choice. It always is.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't go anywhere after I stop recording. I got a few other questions for you, but I know we got to finish this up.
So. Yeah. No problem.
Cody, it's all you, bud.
Hey, Ken, what were we going to say, man?
No, nothing. Nope. I was just telling Bill thank you.
You're welcome. Drinking my tea.
All right, folks. So this has been another amazing Alert Medic One podcast with Cody, Ken, and Mustafa talking to Mr. Bill Dungy from 6 Feet. Mr. Bill, where can people find you out on the interwebs?
Yeah, sure thing. First things first, you can go to Instagram. Look us up, 6Foxtrot, spelled the way it sounds, SIXFOXTROT. Or to 6feet.ca, proudly flying that Canadian flag, for articles on mindset development and gear reviews and just general lifestyle stuff about living the life.
Yeah, guys, give them a click. You won't be disappointed. Thanks, folks, for listening. You know, good evening, good night. Buenos noches, wherever you're from. Have a good one.